good evening and welcome to Bird Calls from Red River Radio, made possible by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. We invite you to call in with your questions tonight about our feathered friends and the avian world during this show at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Cliff Shackelford is our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio, and he is ready to answer your questions about birds tonight. Cliff is currently the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, a position he has held since 1997, and he has been an avid bird watcher for more than 30 years. He is also the first author of the book Hummingbirds of Texas, published in 2005 by Texas A&M Press, and he has authored over 60 publications on birds. He and his wife, Julie, and their two kids live in East Texas. Cliff, welcome back.
Love being here.
And so we're going to start out tonight's show. At the end of the last show, we had a conservation moment, a little conservation tip, and we'd like to refresh you on those. So we're going to start out with a refreshing of last month's or last program's conservation tip.
Yeah, last month we ended with the tip of leaving dead wood, and that means leaving dead snags, leaving logs on the ground. There are a lot of birds that use dead wood. Of course, we think of woodpeckers, first of all. And the cavities they excavate can be used by not only the woodpeckers, but later on when they abandon those, they can be reused by other species. Also, raptors like to perch on snags. It makes it really easy to see a red-tailed hawk or a barred owl sitting out on dead wood. So we recommend it if it's a dead tree, it's not going to fall on anything important like the house or the car or the playscape, leave it up. And then if it does fall down, don't worry about cleaning it up if it's in the back 40. Leave it on the ground. There'll be still pileated woodpeckers will come to it and excavate the beetle larvae that are in there. The beetles are, of course, working on helping decompose that wood. So there's a whole ecosystem almost going on inside there. Life in a dead wood is what I like to think of it. And so leave the dead wood standing if possible.
Give us a call right now if you'd like to ask Cliff a question tonight about our birds and the avian world at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And we always start out each program with a little spotlight on a bird. And what are we going to be spotlighting this month?
Yeah, this month I thought we'd turn the lights off and think about a bird that we hear at night. And a lot of us learned the name for a different species that really just passes through here. So we're going to spotlight on the chuckwill's widow, and we've got that vocalization right here.
A pretty bird, but it's awful lonely at night when you just hear that one bird.
That's right. And so this is a member of the nightjar or goatsucker family, and it's named after its vocalization. So he sounds like he's saying Chuckwill's widow. We know Bob White and Killdeer, there are other birds like that where they're named for their, it's called onomatopoeic. So a goatsucker, it's a term used for birds for the nightjar family that to early shepherds, sheep herders, they looked like the birds were feeding suckling from the goat's teat and drinking milk, but in fact they were feeding on the flies and other pesky insects around the goats. That's where they get the name goatsucker. So the chuckwill's widow is an aerial insectivore, meaning he flies around and catches insects, mainly beetles and moths, on the wing. And they also do eat small birds and bats and frogs, but insects are the primary diet of this bird. And then there's a sound alike. We're going to play the one that we often confuse it with. So let's play the whippoorwill.
You can tell it starts out with an upward swoop, but it's a lot faster than the chuckwill widow.
it's just a very different, the accents are different, and a lot of us learned the name whippoorwill. It's the one that's common in a lot of literary works, and so people just assume that that nighttime calling nightjar is a whippoorwill, and it can be in migration in our listening area. Whippoorwills pass through starting in mid to late March and extend for 4 to 6 weeks roughly. But if you hear one of those in the Shreveport area or Nacogdoches where I live or Livingston, if you hear one of those starting now and into the summer, it's a chuckwill's widow.
Okay.
So to get to the whippoorwills, you've got to go the Wachitas and you've got to go just a little farther north, and then you can pick up whippoorwills and chucks. But right here where we are in Shreveport, they're all chucks this time of the year, and that's the dominant nesting nightjar here.
And are those mostly out in the wooded areas, or are they actually, you know, here in the city as well?
Well, they don't like the cities. They don't like all the lights. They don't like the cities, so they're out in the country. Let's see. They prefer openings or open forests or maybe a mix of the two. But yeah, if you've got a lot of lights, you probably don't have a lot of chuckwill's widows. There might be one farm light, but you typically hear them way out in the forest where you got big chunks of forest and you've got dark skies. That's typically where your chuckwill's widows are. Their sounds really loud.
Yeah.
You don't really want one right outside the window if you get the windows open. It's kind of, I liken it to a thunderstorm or a train.
Mm-hmm.
Those are two things that sound really nice when they're way off, but not when they're right on top of you. So the chuckwill's widow is very pleasant, in my opinion, but when it's way off. If you're camping and he's right above your tent, it's going to be a problem. It's going to be like pitching your tent right next to the railroad.
Well, that's like a mockingbird in the middle of the night,
yes.
Especially outside my window,
right.
Which he's still there. Give us a call tonight if you'd like to talk to Cliff about anything having to do with our avian world, 800-552-8502. We do have our first caller online. I don't have your name, but go ahead. You're online with Cliff Shackelford. What's your question?
My question is this. We live on the east shore of Toledo Bend Lake, and my name is Hill, by the way, the east shore of Toledo Bend Lake, and typically over the last 5 or 6 years, we have spring goldfinches are all over our bird feeders in the spring, and when it gets warm enough, they all disappear, apparently going north. But the last 2 years, and especially this year, we've barely seen any goldfinches, and is the goldfinch migration shifted somewhere else somewhere, or the goldfinches disappeared? What's going on with goldfinches?
That's a good question, and if you've got your ears tuned on to goldfinch vocalizations, you heard them, but they were just up 60, 70, 80 feet up in the trees feeding on what Mother Nature provided this year. So I heard lots of goldfinches and pine siskins. Those are two favorite birds that come to our feeders, but they'd rather eat what Mother Nature provides. It's like home cooking. And the stuff we put in our feeder is secondary to that to them. So I think that this was just a banner year for seed production. There was a really good crop of sweet, juicy tree buds. In late February and into March and even into now, that is a food source for goldfinches as well. Sweet gums did bumper crop. That's a really good food source for goldfinches. So I think they were here. We just didn't see them at our feeder, and we cannot gauge bird abundance by what comes to our feeder, because this was a great year to show that there were birds here. They just didn't come to our feeders. They would rather eat that home cooking.
That's very interesting. Good for them.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks.
And you are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio, and we are your community-supported public broadcasting service. Tonight, our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford, is with us. He is with the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. He's their non-gain ornithologist statewide. He's here to answer your questions. Give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We have Lee online next. Lee, what's your question?
Well, I live just outside of Jacksonville in the country, and every year we used to have a lot of chickadees and nuthatches about now, and they would come. I'd put a feeder out, and I'd just put stuff on the ground for them, and they'd come and cover up the ground. this year, I haven't seen one of either of them. Is something wrong?
Yeah, and that's related to the last caller that I mentioned. There was just a bumper crop of Mother Nature's bountiful food for all these things that we like to lure into seed. They were finding everything they needed out in nature. There's no sky falling. I mean, sure, there's been bird declines. It's slow with a lot of these species. I'm not trying to avoid that, but if people think that they went from seeing dozens to zero as if the sky is falling, that's not happening. So the chickadees are here. The nuthatches are here. They were just finding food elsewhere. And I think the way to do this, if you don't believe me, is learn these vocalizations on your own and test it out. When you go outside, you will hear these chickadees, these nuthatches, these goldfinches, these pine siskins. They're all out there, and it's your ears that are going to find them more than your eyes. These are all tiny little birds that just blend in and are very difficult to see, but boy, are they noisy. And if you learn their voices, it's the difference between Johnny Cash and Mick Jagger and Paul McCartney. And if you learn how those guys sing with birds, you'll find out that they're there and they're just elsewhere in the forest, and they're eating what they're supposed to eat. We have to remember that what did these birds do before we settled this land? So they're doing what they were meant to do. And so our feeders are purely supplemental and not sustenance. What Mother Nature provides is sustenance. So think about that. If you're worried about your feeder birds, just remember, what did they eat before you put your feeders out and your fathers and so forth? Because let me tell you, nobody was putting seed out in the year 1850.
Right.
Okay. So this is a pretty recent thing, and these birds have been here longer than white man settled this land. So something's going right, and it's still going on. So we're not having a sky falling issue.
Okay,
yeah.
Well, that answers my question, Cliff.
Okay, very good.
All
thanks,
right.
Lee.
Thank you, Lee, for calling in. And that does bring a question up for me, and that is that given all the rain that we've had, which usually makes things a little lusher, is this going to be a bountiful year for the birds and the natural crops, would you think, given
well,
the rain?
I'm glad you brought up the rain, because we often hear about people wondering what drought does, the opposite of plentiful rain. So where I live, and most of, west of where I live, 2011, mm-hmm. 2010 were just drought years. And, of course, the media picks up on that, and they call, and they're like, oh, my gosh, what's the drought doing to birds? But when we're – and that's kind of – you can address that. But when it's the opposite, like right now, no one ever asks, what are these floodwaters doing to birds and other things? And it's, you know, it just depends on the bird. If you're a wood duck or a hooded merganser and you like flooded forests, it's a great year. If you're down on the coast, if you're a prairie chicken, or if you're a bobwhite and your eggs are on the ground and then they hatch and those little guys start running around the ground and the ground's underwater, you can do the math. You can figure out what a wet year does to what we call gallinaceous birds that are on the ground. But these cycles are important. So, for example, these river bottoms that are flooding, this is essential. And they are here to move waters back into the forest. They're depositing nutrients, which makes the forest healthier. So in the long run, this is very good for birds overall, but there are going to be exceptions to that. And of course, we don't have time to go through each and every species, but flooding's good, drought is good. These extremes are part of the system, kind of weeds out a lot of things. Like the drought will suddenly thin a forest out and make the forest maybe more of a natural setting than it should be when it was maybe overcrowded. So it's just a back and forth with droughts, floods, and everybody wants normal, something like Goldilocks and in between, but we don't often have a Goldilocks here in the temperate zone. It's not very consistent. It's very irregular, and that's good.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502 if you'd like to talk to Cliff tonight. We have Lee online next from Zavala. Lee, you're online with Cliff. What's your question? Hello, Lee? Okay, next caller. You're online with Cliff Shackelford. If you can hear me, go ahead.
Yeah, hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi, I live on a lake in northeast Texas, and we have a huge population of white pelicans that have taken up residence here during the winter, and then they leave and go somewhere else. I don't know where. I guess my question is, have they expanded their range into this area, and where do they go when they leave here?
Yeah, most of the white pelicans go up to Montana, the Dakotas, the prairie potholes, southern Canada, and they breed in inland fresh waters. So, you know, the lakes in Texas and Louisiana, that, you know, most of them, 99% of them, are not natural. So, you know, what we've done is provided these Exxon gas stations for these birds to stop off and refuel. So, historically, before the first dam was built, so let's go back. I mentioned 1850 earlier. Let's go back to 1850. They would have, if they had to go down, they would have used the larger rivers. So in your case, maybe the Sulphur or the Red. But all these lakes have just made it super easy, stock tanks too, for birds to stop and either overwinter or maybe just overnight. So yeah, you're going to have winter birds and you're going to have migrants, and but they're not going to be here in the hot months. These birds are smart. They're a lot smarter than me because they go up to where it's really nice and cool to raise young. It's a lot more tolerable than down here. And then guess what? Those waters ultimately freeze, so they got to get out of there. So they move down south where water doesn't freeze, and that's why they come back. And it's a great example of a bird that's triggered by the environment, has to move because of the water and food availability.
Well, great. They're fun to watch, too.
Great. Yep, they are.
All right. Thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you. And you are listening to Bird Calls from Red River Radio with Cliff Shackelford, our resident ornithologist. You can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502 if you'd like to talk to Cliff tonight about anything having to do with our avian world. And we're going to go next to, I believe it's Mark. Mark, you're online next with Cliff. What's your question?
I live over in Bossier City near a pond, and it didn't happen often, but it was probably it was either a large falcon or a hawk that would be way high up in the air, and then it would almost like it was hovering, and then it would drop like a rocket. I mean, it just went straight down, and I bet it was 200-300 feet up in the air, and it would just come down. I was thinking that might have been a peregrine falcon, but I didn't know if we had those around here.
Yeah, we do have peregrines, but they typically don't forage that way. They'll stay in flight. They won't do the hovering so much. They'll circle around and stoop. So what you saw, if he was a big, husky, fluffy-looking guy, was probably a red-tailed hawk, what we often call chicken hawk. And you'll see red-tailed hawks do that. They'll get pretty high up, and they see something. Maybe it's a rabbit. He doesn't know. He's going to look. He's going to hover. Maybe the rabbit went under a bush. He's going to stay hovering because that rabbit might come out. And then if that rabbit comes out, or rat, boom, that's when you see him just drop like a football coming down after a punt. And that's probably the red-tailed hawk. If it's a little bitty guy, you'll see kestrels do that. The former name is Sparrowhawk, and the current name is American Kestrel, but they're tiny. They're dove-sized, and you'll see them do that too along roadsides. But my guess is you had a red-tailed hawk doing that.
Great, thank you.
Yep.
And I have a question. I recorded this. I know it's an owl, but I wasn't quite sure what kind of owl. We had recorded this outside of my apartment complex right here in Shreveport. But
oh, nice! Right in the city, huh?
As you can tell, it's right next to a fairly loud air conditioning unit.
Yeah.
But I was curious as to what kind, because that's kind of like the common one you hear a lot on TV shows and in movie soundtracks and the like.
And it's real deep, and his handle, what we like to call a handle, where you can kind of put to words what he's saying. It sounds like he's saying, "Who's awake? Me too."
Right.
"Who's awake? Me too." But with hoots. And that's the great horned owl.
Okay.
And so he's our largest owl. He's very powerful. He eats mid-sized mammals. You know, think of skunks and raccoon-sized mammals.
Oh, really? That big? Huh?
Yeah, that big. They'll of course, go after big rats, too. So all these raptors we're talking about, hawks and kestrels and owls, we have to remember, these guys are doing us a service. And, you know, the old days, people were just worried about the couple chickens they lost, or the thought of losing domesticated animals. But that shouldn't outweigh what these guys are doing as far as what we call ecosystem services. And that's keeping our these pests in check. If we didn't have hawks, falcons, owls, and even snakes and other predators, we would be overrun with mice and rats. So you should salute these guys and let them do their thing because they're working for you.
All right. You are listening to Bird Calls with Cliff Shackelford, and you can give us a call now at 800-552-8502 and ask him a question tonight on our program, anything to do with our avian world and birds. And we're going to go to our next caller, and you are online with Cliff. What's your question tonight? Hello?
Hello?
Yes, you're online with Cliff.
Yes, sir. I was calling. I've got like a two-part question. The first one is I have a red-headed woodpecker that pecks on my antenna pole. That makes a rather loud noise. And I was wondering if he was doing that for communication purposes. And it's probably the opposite of what you normally hear as far as attracting birds. But if you wanted to attract crows to your yard, how would you do that?
If you wanted to attract crows?
Yes.
Huh. Well, I know there are a lot of pecan orchard farmers that would tell you that they've got lots of crows when the pecans come out, and they don't like the crows because they're eating their crops. So I'd say plant you 50 pecan trees, wait 40 years, and you'll get lots of crows. But no, that's a tough one. I mean, crows are very omnivorous. I mean, if you put... They'll go to trash. You see them now. It's unfortunate that you see them in parking lots. They're eating out of dumpsters and the French fries we drop. So I don't know what really you can do with crows other than certain crops that they'll get. But those crops are seasonal. So the problem with the pecan is it's only going to produce for you for a few weeks of the year, and then you've got nothing going on with that pecan orchard. So your first question was on the woodpecker, and that's a great question. I'm glad you brought that up because that's a form of communication. And a lot of woodpeckers starting in the late winter, really peaks in late winter and through the spring and summer, they're doing what's called drumming. So when you hear a bird like yours using metal or wood where it really resonates, they like metal roofs, they like gutters, they like telephone poles, anything that gets them a really loud resonance like this, that brrr, brrr. So that's not excavating. They're communicating when they do that drumming. It's super fast. If you could slow it down, it's amazing how many hits there are per second. And it varies with species. But your bird is communicating. He's doing several things with that communication. Number one, he's telling other males, hey, this is my territory, this is my home, you stay out. And he also could be talking to females or at least keeping that female pair bond together with that as well. So it's usually the males doing it, and it's for communication, and the louder the better. So when they find things like these metal things we put up, they love it. Yep.
All right, well, I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Yep,
thank you. You are listening to Bird Calls with Cliff Shackelford, our resident ornithologist. You can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We're going to go to our next caller. You're online with Cliff. What's your question tonight? Hello, caller. Yes.
Two questions and a couple of comments. For the previous caller, my neighbor raises quite a few watermelons. And he uses a propane gun, and that's pretty effective at just the noise, you know, keeping the crows out of his crop.
Okay.
And the other thing is, thanks for putting on the call of the Chuck Wills Widow.
Good. Is that one you still hear around your parts?
Yeah. And that's exactly what it is. And he's pretty close to the house at night. Shows up early spring, late April.
Yep.
Somewhere about that time. Mm-hmm. And I can hear him or her close to the house, maybe a couple hundred feet away in a tree. And I can hear a distant answer from another one or two of those same birds.
Uh-huh. That's fantastic.
It is.
Yep.
And I heard him just last night.
Oh, good.
Okay. The questions, first of all, I'm in Vernon Parish, which borders on Texas.
Uh-huh.
And I've noticed locally, anyway, and driving around, I hardly ever see a turkey vulture anymore, but I see plenty of black vultures. Is that just because of the area I'm in, or has there been a decline in the year?
There's not been a decline. There's actually been an increase in both those species, so I don't know what you're seeing. I see plenty of turkey vultures. I see plenty of black vultures, so... I don't know what to tell you other than it's they're there. They're there, and there's more than there would have been 100 years ago.
Oh, okay.
I mean, we're doing things that vultures like. They're cleaning off our roadsides. They're cleaning up scraps out in the farms, but and garbage, and they can get to be pesky, too, and problematic. But, no, I've not seen any declines in those birds at all.
I see them mostly on the roadside.
Yeah.
The other question is, a couple nights ago, I was out unloading some feed in the barn, and it's pretty dark at night here now, this phase of the moon. And my headlight picked up a reflection of some eyes that were, you know, essentially white or silver reflection.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know, it was across a fire lane, and it was low to the ground. I couldn't see anything but the reflection of the eyes. But after a while, it moved. It flew, and it flew in a small circle, low and then up and back over to where it originally was. And I figure it was some kind of small owl, but I'm not sure. That's not much to go on, but could you venture a guess?
I would venture a guess, but when you see those white to lime green to silver eyes, those are typically mammals. So your birds are typically red to orange eyed. So I don't know. I can't explain what you saw. You may have had two things going at once. Maybe a gray fox was about to pounce on a Chuckwill's widow. I don't know. And so you saw the eyes of the fox, and then you saw the bird flying away. But
I could only see the reflection of the eyes when it was flying.
Yeah,
it would fly low for, you know, about the width of the fire lane, and then rise up and circle back over and light about the same place.
Yeah, that doesn't fit a bird. I mean, I have limited experience looking at birds at night with spotlights, but in my limited experience, those are going to be mammal eyes, and it's a difference in the rods in the eyes and the reflection of those with our lights. And so, in my experience, and I'm trying to think here, but I don't think I've seen an exception to a bird that you know. And some of the owls don't shine back, but the Caprimulgids, and that's interesting. You asked about. The eyes shine at night because that we highlight the Chuckwill's widow. They'll fly off the road, and their eyes are typically a reddish orange, if I'm not mistaken. So I don't know what you saw. I see these same silvery white eyes on mammals, and when something takes off, you know, a deer might be sitting on the ground, and it looks low, and then when he stands up, there's 3 feet. And then he runs. Deer's the number one thing I'm thinking of, and that maybe he was sitting and then he stood up and he ran, and then I don't know what to tell you other than that. That's gonna be it.
And the deer I've seen have big yellow eyes.
Yeah, and it's.
I have quite a few of those around here.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think you got something to look forward to next time you're out and about with your headlights, because it's tricky to note what all these things are doing and who the eyes belong to. So, yeah, give it a shot.
And I'd be curious, is that possible that a bat could reflect back like that?
I don't know that I've ever seen a bat eye reflection before. I've gone to many bat caves in Central Texas where they're thousands and thousands of the Mexican free-tailed bats, mm-hmm. and I'm trying to think, and I've never seen an eye reflection, but no one's really shining a light at them either.
Yeah.
But they are flying up in the city in Austin. If you go the Congress mm-hmm. Street Bridge over Lake Lady Bird, I never see eye shine. So I don't know. Those are good questions for some of the very specialized expertise on eyes and animals. And that's not me.
Ophthalmologist.
Yeah, a bat ophthalmologist, right. And that's not me.
Yeah. Well, you are listening to Bird Calls tonight, not ophthalmology calling. And Cliff Shackelford is our resident ornithologist. You can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We're going to go to our next call. And you are online with Cliff. What's your question tonight?
Hello?
Yes, hello. You're online with Cliff. What's your question?
Great. I wonder if you could tell me what kind of management of my bird boxes I should do. I have four bird boxes, and typically I will clean them. I'll monitor them, and then when the birds fledge, I clean out the nest, and I'm beginning to wonder whether I'm being a little too fastidious or what, but I clean it out, and I also spray it with miticide to prepare for the next nest.
And do you
Is
know
that something I should be doing?
Well, do you know what birds were finished up nesting? What species are we talking about?
Yes, the bluebirds,
uh-huh.
and then I have also
chickadees or titmice.
Chickadees, and an occasional flying fox. I'm not flying fox.
Flying squirrel.
Flying squirrel.
Yeah.
But I just like to make a nice, clean nesting box for them.
Well, okay, for the birds that you mentioned, let's put three together. You mentioned two of them, bluebird. That's eastern bluebird here, Carolina chickadee, and tufted titmouse. For those three, I would say you're doing the right thing, because part of the nesting cycle involves building the nest. And even though it just got used, it could be another pair, or it might be the same pair re-nesting. But building the nest is part of the pair bond. It's part of the event. And I think that also, if you've ever looked closely, sometimes when they're done, it's covered in mites. Birds are just stricken with feather mites, and they can just get to be outrageous, and they can actually kill the nestlings before they're able to fledge. So I think that if you leave that nest material in there, it can just keep them going. If there's a little bit of part, you know, like eggshells they can feed on or whatever, maybe feathers and things in there that can keep them going. So getting out the nest material is good for the whole thing, for the second nesting. They can start clean. Yeah. So I'd say keep doing that for those birds. And the bluebird people will tell you that too, that you want to have the box cleaned out, let them redo the nest and to their liking, and it makes, you know, maybe a stronger pair bond. The male gets to show how good he is at providing, and so it's just part of it is building the nest. Yeah, so keep up the good work.
The other thing is that I've got a little wren that has nests in a kind of a pottery tube that hangs on the wall. And I'm just wondering, is that the cleaning out of the nest true for the wren as well?
Yes, I would recommend that too, because here's another thing to think about. If they only use it once and then they got to wait 11, 12 months to use it again, all that fine material, grasses, rootlets, etc., they get just mushy and nasty with the weather we have. With even the inside that tube, there's humidity, and it's working on decomposing those fine nest materials. So they'd rather have it be dry and fresher. So it is good to take all that out of there. And I should mention with the wrens, and a lot of people probably have observed this and maybe didn't realize it, that several species of wrens will build what we call a dummy nest. And that a dummy nest is a nest that they've built, but they're never going to use it. They're going to go to it and pretend they're using it. And the idea is that they're luring predators to the wrong spot, and that, you know, they really have like a bat cave hidden over there where the real nest is. Think of Batman and his hidden bat cave. So they're trying to really keep the bat cave hidden, but they're going to be really obvious and conspicuous at the dummy nest. And so the reason it's called dummy nest in one way is because we're the dummy for thinking that it's a real nest. So they fooled us, right? So also dummy because it's not a real nest on their part. But I like to think that we're the fools by thinking it's a nest, that it's not active. So in other words, some of these wrens, like our Carolina wrens, might build one or two extra nests that they never use, and they spend a lot of time at it and looking around and hoping to lure somebody over there, but the goods are in the real nest, and that's often very well hidden. They're all very well hidden, but maybe they'll spend a lot more time near the dummy nest to be conspicuous. And we've been fooled before. We've got an outdoor cubby with shoes and boots and Crocs and flip-flops, and they on occasion the wrens will build in there, and we'll think, okay, we can't ever wear those shoes until the nesting cycle's done. Well, we've looked at those shoes in past breeding season, and there's never an egg in it, never lays an egg in it, and it's because it's a dummy nest, dummy, right?
Yeah.
So it makes a lot of fun. Not many birds in our area do that, but the wrens do that really well. There's several species of wrens. As you go farther west into Texas, there are a lot more species of wrens, and several of those build dummy nests as well.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call tonight with questions about anything having to do with our avian world at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Cliff is currently the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. We're going to go to our next caller now, and you are online with Cliff. What's your question tonight? Hello, caller?
Good evening.
Yes.
Hello.
Yes.
Hey, he did say anything, didn't he?
Yes.
okay. Have you ever heard of any birds that have like a like great blue heron or anything that has like a worldwide range?
Are you asking if there are any birds that occur worldwide?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Okay. The great blue heron is not one of those. There are several species, and what we. What we like to look at is whether they breed worldwide. That's really tough. But they're, let's see, the peregrine falcon is almost global. Caspian tern, maybe. I'm just thinking here. That's a good, tough question. Osprey, maybe. You'll have to check me on these.
How about eagles?
No, none of the eagles. The golden eagle is what we call whole Arctic. That means he's on the northern hemispheres globally. So that means he's in Europe and Asia and North America. Right. So he's in the northern part of the globe, but the caller's asking about everywhere, and that's tough to do. I mean, you got to pretty much exclude Antarctica. You know, that's an ice continent. There's just not a lot of potential for a lot of birds there.
Penguins.
Yeah. So there are not many. You know, we helped with the house sparrow. It's not quite global, but it almost is, and because of humans bringing them in. Gosh, that's a good question. I haven't thought about that in a long time. So you'll have to look up those. Let's see. I mentioned peregrine, osprey, Caspian tern, house sparrow. I'll tell you, in the New World, the one we played a minute ago that Bill played, the great horned owl, that has a tremendous range in the New World. In this hemisphere, it's all the way from the tundra to Tierra del Fuego. That means he's from northern Canada and Alaska all the way to southern Chile and Argentina. So in the New World, that has a tremendous range. There are a lot of birds that, well, not a lot, but there are several birds that fit that. And then, of course, migratory birds kind of connect the dots. So we've got a lot of shorebirds, for example, that will be in the South American continent in the winter, our winter. But in our breeding season, they'll come up into the North America, U.S. and Canada. So, but that's a good trivial pursuit question. I appreciate that one. It's a good one.
Thank you much.
All right. Thank you for your call. And you are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We have a lot of lines open right now. We do have one more caller online. You're online with Cliff, and what's your question tonight?
Hello.
Hello.
Yes, this is Amelia in Shreveport. I'm wondering how I can keep feeding my birds without attracting rats. And I'm talking about birds coming to my bird feeders.
Yeah.
Last year, my wonderful dog was poisoned but survived some poisoned rat, which we did not put out, but we found out that rats in the neighborhood just keep traveling with the poison and then they stash it. So each time that I put the food out, rats come back.
Yeah, so you're going to have to shut down the restaurant for the time being, and that means clean everything up too. They know there's a food source, they're coming to it. We had a problem one year. The rats, they were Norway rats. There are two big species of rats. They're not native, Norway rat and black rat. And the Norway rat, they had dug holes underneath a tree with the help of some roots. So the roots kind of allowed them to excavate cavities and tunnels. And it was within 5 feet or so of our bird feeder. So what I did is I trapped them. I trapped the rats and got them out of there, and I plugged up the holes. I filled them with dirt and tamped it to, so they wouldn't other ones wouldn't come in there. And so then I had to keep – you just have to keep the area clean. So that's going to be a lot of work on your part. So if you – my recommendation is shut it down. And that means clean it up and don't feed for months. And that the timing is perfect because we don't really need to be feeding birds in the hot summer months.
Right.
The food gets sweaty. The birds don't need it. When we start putting on jackets and scarves and gloves, that's when birds might need food. But right now they don't. So shut it down. Get rid of all the seed. Get out there with a shovel. Scoop it all up, and hopefully they'll move on and find some other source of easy pickings, and then try to trap. So, yeah, the poison is a big issue. If you poison a rat, chances are he's going to hobble outside, and somebody's going to pick up on it. Your dog, your cat, a hawk or owl, and guess what? That transmits from the rat stomach into one of those predators, and you sure don't want it to be your beloved pet, and I sure don't want it to be the hawk or the owl as well. So poisoning is not the way to do it. Trapping is the best way, or if you're in the country, get a BB gun or pellet gun or bigger.
Well, I'm just north of LSU, and actually, as I said, the poison came from my neighbors because the very same day that my dog was poisoned and was at the vet, we found more poison that was dropped in our yard.
Yeah, you're going to have to talk to the neighbors and plead with them. Tell them what's happening. Most people have morals and sympathy and could relate to you and the dog. And that's good because that message there is going to help all these other things like hawks and owls.
One last question. Uh-huh. Okay, you say trap the rats. Uh-huh. How do you do that? We've got traps, and they're too clever. They don't get on them.
Well, you can use the Have-A-Heart traps that are made for walk-in. You just need to make sure you got them small enough that not every fat raccoon's getting in there, too.
Okay.
So look for a Have-A-Heart walking trap. If they're, the snap traps, the big solid ones for the rats, if they're desperate and hungry, they'll get caught. They're not that smart. You just need to probably place it a little better or change what you're using as the bait, make it real desirable.
What's a desirable?
Well, something really smelly, peanut butter or a really nasty cheese. And what I mean by nasty is something that's super yummy and odoriferous.
Limburger,
yeah. I'm not mozzarella. Mozzarella is too bland, too plain. It'd still work, but you want something that really smells and that's going to work on this problem you've got.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Yep.
You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. And you can give us a call tonight if you'd like to ask him a question at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Cliff is currently the statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, and he is with us tonight to answer your questions. And I do have, we had a photo sent in after the last show, and this came from a fella from Texas. His name is Sean Fisher, and he says, I live in Nacogdoches, Texas, but recently traveled to Eureka Springs, Arkansas, and while walking around town, I heard and saw a few different woodpeckers flying around the town, including what I think is a red-headed woodpecker. I was unable to see the face and the belly of the bird or it in flight, but I believe it to be a downy woodpecker, and I do not know what the other tree-clinging bird or type were, but he gave us some things, and then he sent in some photos of one of them that he captured. And what is he? And you can look online, folks, if you'd like to. You can go to our webpage for tonight's show at redriverradio.org, and you'll see this bird there too if you'd like to check it out.
And if the picture I'm looking at is the same one that he identified as a downy, then he gets a gold star, because that's what I see here. It's not the best view of a downy. You can't see the bill, but you can see the outer white tail feathers, what we call the rectrices, and there are little dark spots on those, and I can see that on this bird. So it's a white back. It's got black wings with speckles, so I know it's in a genus of woodpeckers that look very similar, the genus Picoides. But this one, I can see the features that set it apart from hairy woodpecker, red-cockaded woodpecker, and so this is a downy woodpecker. Mm-hmm. It's our most common of the little black and white woodpeckers. He has a little bit of red on the back of the head on the male. Female lacks the red, but they're little bitty. So we're talking, titmouse size, maybe a little chunkier, but not very big of a woodpecker. And also the tree is very dead that it's feeding on in this picture. You can see that there's major decay. I mean, the tree might still be alive, but at least this part of the tree that we're seeing is got a lot of dead stuff, and that's good. There's going to be insects that are attracted to that, and guess what? The woodpecker doesn't kill the tree. If you have a woodpecker in a tree and you think the woodpecker's killing the tree, the woodpecker's there because there's something to eat on the tree or in the tree. And in this case, you can see a lot of excavation and decay, and there's a lot of beetles and beetle larvae inside that wood that this woodpecker is like a gold miner. He's digging it out and feeding on it. So the trees die for various reasons. That the drought we talked about in 2010-11, that was a major killer of trees. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people think a tree's going to die, you know, just fall over and look dead immediately. A lot of trees take months and months and months, even 12 months, even 18 months before they really look dead. So it can be like a really slow dimmer switch when you try to kill a tree, or if Mother Nature kills a tree. You just don't, people aren't, you know, it might be 2012. They're like, well, how come all these trees are dead? The drought's over. Well, the drought did it. It just took a while to get there. So, but this is a downy woodpecker, not a bad photo. And also, I want to change gears real quick and go back to what I said about the cheese. And I should clarify, when I said nasty, I don't mean nasty in the flavor. I love cheeses. I was thinking about that the other day. If I got stuck on an island, it would be, of course, water. Three things: water, bread, and cheese is what would carry me over on Gilligan's Island until I got rescued. So I love cheese. What I meant was just the stinkiest flavor cheese, right. And I love those cheeses too. So when I said nasty, I don't want to offend all you gourmet cheese people. I am a gourmet cheese person myself. I just used a word that
Asiago might do it. Exactly. You are listening to Bird Calls with our resident ornithologist, Cliff Shackelford. You give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And we did have a caller called in and left a message. They said they're a family in McKinney, Texas, and they have an owl family that had moved into the duck box in their backyard. Yeah. And currently there are little owlets. And what they want to know is, one, will the owl return next year, or is there anything they can do to get the owl to stay and return? They said the backyard's up against a wooded area, so there's plenty of mice and snakes available mm-hmm. for the owls. They just kind of like that.
Well,
the owl there.
If they want the owl to return, they've got the number one ingredient is the box. And not every owl nests in a box. I've seen two different species nest in what I'd call a typical wood duck box. The main one is the eastern screech owl because of the size of the hole. But I've seen some that have gotten enlarged a little bit, and I've seen barn owls on a rare occasion get in one. But the barn owl, it's almost not enough real estate for a barn owl. So the ones I've seen, they were kind of souped up duck boxes that they use. But I'm going to guess between those two species, between the eastern screech owl and the barn owl, and both of those occur in McKinney. I grew up in the Dallas area, so they both occur there. But I'm going to guess, I'm going to lean towards eastern screech owl. We don't have a photograph. The caller left a message. I can't ask him questions. The big one would be, do the adults have ear tufts or not? Right. Is the adult darkish or pale? Because a barn owl is very white versus a screech owl is very bark colored. The gray morphs are very gray. The box is what they need. But see, there are other owls that don't nest in boxes. So not all owls are cavity using. But those two I mentioned are, and I'm guessing they have an eastern screech owl. Yep.
And that does bring up a good thing. If you happen to, you know, have your cell phone camera, any kind of camera out there now, you know, obviously we've got to be able to distinguish the bird. But when you send us a photo, it makes it a lot easier to identify, as we've had over the course of
this
show, lots of photos sent to us. And that makes it easy. So by all means, send in your photos. If they're not good enough, that's fine. We'll do our best, but send them in. It's kind of fun.
And when a bird is nesting like these screech owls, you don't need to get so close with your camera that you got to open the box and scare the heck out of everybody, because just think, you look like Godzilla
right
to these birds. So keep Godzilla back, use a different camera, and try to get your pictures without, you know, getting right in their face, because that's a sensitive time for birds. And so I like to tell people to keep your distance. And actually, I should make a plug for nature photographers or would-be or promising nature photographers. They go down to the coast and they get way too close to these rookeries, where we have spoil islands that reddish egrets and brown pelicans and a whole bunch of other birds are nesting. And they get their boat too close, and all of a sudden everybody flies off the nest, and the babies freak out and they jump out of the nest. And I don't know who wouldn't think that they're causing mass chaos like Godzilla.
Yeah.
So I'd say keep Godzilla in the movies and don't make him come to life, and just keep your distance from birds, especially when they're nesting. It's just obvious. And I don't want people, you know, when my little kids were in the cart in the grocery store, I didn't like other people coming up too close and grabbing my kids and pinching them. I was like, you need to keep your distance, man. This baby is pure and sweet, and here you are touching my kid. Step back. So I feel for these birds when I was breeding and had a little nestling, so to speak. So
time for a better telephoto lens.
Yeah, that's right.
We're going to go to our next caller, and you are online with Cliff. And what's your question tonight? Hello?
Hello?
Yes, you're online with Cliff Shackelford. What's your question?
Okay, I was just wondering, growing up, you know, Caddo Parish, DeSoto Parish, there was a lot of quail, and now, you know, I don't see them anymore. You know, did they move on, or just what happened to them? And maybe also, if you have time, what can I do to get bluebirds around the house, and, you know, will they stay around during the summer?
Well, let's start with the latter question, the bluebirds. And you can put up boxes. You can go online, look up the North American Bluebird Society, or in my state, we have the Texas Bluebird Society. It's just a state level or state chapter of the national. And they give you all kinds of blueprints on that. So put up a bluebird box. You need to have openings. If you're in a dense forest, bluebirds don't like dense forests. They got to have openings or edges. The quail are gone because we have altered the system here. We have gotten rid of native grasses, and we've replaced them with non-native grasses, and quail are gone for good until we can figure out how to bring back native warm season grasses. So if you came here, 200 years ago, you would have had little blue stem and other native grasses and lots of forbs in the understory of these pines, and there were quail, there were turkey, there were Bachman sparrows. But we have changed the way we manage our forests. And the first thing we've done is get rid of the grasses. And then in the pasture land, we've taken out native grasses and replaced them with non-native grasses from other continents. And we wonder why quail aren't here. Well, heck, we've just changed the stage for them that they stand on and just made it so different that they don't like it. And I don't blame them. So quail are nationwide are about a 68% decline. It's much worse in certain parts of the country. The Blackland Prairies in Texas, about a 94% decline. They're almost gone in parts of the country. And I think two more generations, quail is going to be on the list with at-large prairie chicken. It's going to be the next endangered species in that gallinaceous group.
And we have quickly time for one more quick question. And our final caller, you're online with Cliff. What's your question tonight?
Hey, first, thanks for the show. I really enjoyed it. That nighttime bird, that goat sucking bird, I've been here tonight. That's a great identification.
Man. Good.
I was wondering what was out there in the woods in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
But we bought a place out. We're east in Nacogdoches, about 30 miles, and it came with some nice purple marlin houses and some gourds. And I know I'm too late this year, but what are some tips to maybe attract them for next year? And do I need to take them down and get them all cleaned out, and get them all ready? Or
yeah. Okay, I would clean them out, and then, you know, purple martins like it open, so you can't put their apartment complex under a tree or in the forest. It has to be out in an opening. It's like an airport where you've got jumbo jets or, you know, fighter jets, rather. Let's think of the purple martins as fighter jets. They've got to have a lot of clearing and space, and so they like those boxes to be out in the open. So a lot of people wonder why they don't get purple martins. Well, if you're all forested, that's the reason. So keep it out in the open. Look up the Purple Martin Conservation Association. They're based in Pennsylvania. They've got a great website, and there are lots of tips on how to bring in purple martins. So try the PMCA, the Purple Martin Conservation Association website, and you can learn more about purple martins and how to attract them.
And we're going to close out tonight's show with this month's conservation tip from Cliff. What do you got for us this month?
This month, we're going to tie it to the Chuckwills Widow. And the title is Dark Skies at Night Can Help Our Birds. So over 80% of Americans live in cities or suburbs. On a clear night, most urban and suburban residents will never witness the glow of stars or the Milky Way in our night sky. Some children never will experience the sight of but a few of the brightest stars above. Most migratory birds, especially our songbirds, migrate during the night when it's cooler, they're less predators, and the night stars are thought to aid them with navigation. But migrating birds often collide with lighted buildings and towers at night. Cities in the U.S. and Canada have tall buildings that are a huge threat to migratory birds. For example, it's estimated that 90,000 birds die annually in New York City alone because of collisions with buildings. A 25-year study that began in the 1960s by Herbert Stoddard at a single TV tower in northern Florida found that more than 42,000 birds were killed, representing 189 species, mostly warblers and vireos, species that eat insects in our forests and gardens. On mornings during spring migration, when we lived in Austin, my wife worked downtown and witnessed people walking the sidewalks to their offices, having to step over dead warblers and other migrants that flew into downtown windows the night before. She even saw building cleanup crews sweeping up the dead birds before 8 a.m. Some office buildings across the country, after a bit of pleading, are turning off non-essential lights during bird migration in order to avoid this. Cities like Chicago, New York, and Toronto. So consider pleading with owners and managers of tall lighted buildings and towers in your area. So the Chuckwills Widow we highlighted near the beginning of the show prefers dark skies lit with natural light from the stars and the moon. Artificial lights also confuse nocturnal insects, but nothing like the day when mercury vapor lights were the norm. Remember gagging on all those insects that were attracted to and swirling around your porch light? So, use minimal outdoor lighting around your house and property. Keep our skies dark. Use bulbs with the lowest wattage possible, and point your lights downward instead of skyward outside. The amateur astronomers in your neighborhood are going to thank you for that. Turn lights out as much as possible. Doing all this saves energy, which will save you money on your electric bill. So do it for your pocketbook, but also do it for the birds.
Thanks, Cliff. You have been listening to Bird Calls with Cliff Shackelford, our resident ornithologist here at Red River Radio and a statewide non-game ornithologist for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department. We want to thank everybody at the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department for their help tonight. on this program, and I personally want to thank Cliff for joining us once again tonight. This has been Bird Calls, produced here in the studios of Red River Radio by Bill Beckett and Cliff Shackelford, with help from Wally Derleth, Renee Moran, and Henry Edwards. And the audio for tonight's program will be posted on our website in a few hours. And remember, if you have a photo or a sound clip of a bird that you would like Cliff to identify, you can always send it to my email at wbeckett@lsus.edu. We are KDAQ, Shreveport Bossier City, KLSA Alexandria Pineville, KBSA El Dorado Magnolia, and KLDN Lufkin Nacogdoches.